Knowing that they had an appointment to keep off the coast of Japan, the British Pacific Fleet made tracks for Australian dockyards. Their primary task was to make good the wear, tear and kamikaze damage that the carriers had endured. Formidable had three of her deck armour panels removed, as the kamikaze had annoyingly hit right at the junction of all three. Two were simply taken over to a big hydraulic press and then hammered straight, then reinstalled. But the last one was a bit more distorted in a rather complex and interesting fashion, and also had a degree of fire damage to it, so it was discarded, with a replacement plate being fashioned from two layers of 1.5-inch thick steel. While that was going on, her machinery was also overhauled, but considerably more work was needed on Indomitable, primarily fixing her central propeller shaft. Various other ships had minor defects and small bits of damage made good as well, as Sydney veritably swarmed with dockyard workers and sailors on leave. There was also something of a harbinger of things to come as the light fleet carrier HMS Pioneer had arrived. It was fitted as an aircraft maintenance carrier, just like Unicorn. Pioneer was one of several Colossus-class carriers that were in the process of making their way across various oceans to join the British Pacific Fleet. Since the next stage of operations was to be off Japan, the logistics chain also needed some work, including working out which route supplies would run in the process of getting from Australia to the front line, and how much more of an expansion of facilities in Australia was needed to facilitate this. There was another area of improvement in terms of exactly what kind of supplies would be taken. Thanks to the previous operations, there was now a more realistic idea of what was actually used and how quickly it was used. So items that had previously been shipping in quantity but turned out to be rarely used could be reduced, while other items which had run low or run out completely could take up the freed up space in the fleet train's holds. This would be further assisted by a decision to simplify the number of variations on various items that would be embarked, where at all possible, as much standardisation was to be enacted as was reasonable. The simple fact that more supply ships were arriving further helped matters, as did the rationalisation of the fleet train, with the large number of Victory ship hulls that had arrived as mentioned in the previous British Pacific Fleet video, allowing the sharp end of the supply lines to use a more standardised and modern ship, and some of the older and odder vessels previously in the fleet train that weren't specialists could now be used on shuttle duty back and forth from the rear echelon bases. More pilots were gradually arriving, but the RAAF, that's the Royal Australian Air Force, lent a hand, as with most of the combat having moved far from Australia's coasts, and with, of course, the war in Europe over, there were quite a lot of experienced RAAF Spitfire pilots who could relatively easily transfer over to flying Seafires. By picking from the most experienced of the volunteers, the Fleet Air Arm would soon gain a valuable batch of veteran flyers, who would in turn go on to form the core of the Royal Australian Navy's own aircraft carrier force in the post-war environment. Although their conversion training ended up taking up most of what was left of the war, although of course they didn't know that at this point. Some of the fleet's experienced long-time aviators were also rotated back to Australia to form a nucleus of a backup carrier air group, something they'd picked up from the US Navy. This would in theory allow a carrier that was operational but had an exhausted complement of flyers to simply swap them out and return to the front lines with a new batch of pilots in relatively short order, instead of having to wait around for its air group to rest and recuperate. By the time the fleet was ready to sail again, the fleet train had ballooned to a total of around 150 ships, about two-thirds of them being supply vessels and a third of them escorts. Also growing was the presence of British submarines. The Eastern Fleet had been receiving more and more submarines in the mid to late 1944 period, largely on account of an almost complete absence of Kriegsmarine targets in the North Sea and the surrounding environs, but while the British Pacific Fleet had been off antagonising the Japanese around Sakishima, the 8th Submarine Flotilla had moved up to the front lines, basing itself out of the Philippines, centred around the submarine depot ship HMS Maidstone. Initially, the port was quite austere, and conditions on the Maidstone were one step removed from hellish, as she was completely overloaded when various submarine crews came aboard for rest. But it turned out this could be rapidly alleviated, as some of the crew informed a nearby roving pack of wild seabees that, among other things, the ship was carrying almost 60,000 bottles of Australian beer. Almost overnight, a portion of the shoreside jungle vanished in a spray of wood chips, and a rest and relaxation camp magically appeared, to the general joy of all concerned. This submarine effort soon started to pay off. Although British submarines were generally smaller and, with the exception of the latest models of the T-class, shorter range than the big American fleet boats, this smaller size actually made them more suited to prowling shallower coastal waters, where the Gatos and Belows had to exercise a bit more caution, thus plugging a gap that a few brave Japanese ships had been using. Among these various successes was the ambush of the Japanese heavy cruiser Ashigara, which was stalked by HMS Trenchant. Now, the T-class, of which Trenchant was one, had been designed specifically for such warship hunting missions, and although compared to earlier T-boats the Trenchant had had two amidships external tubes turned around to face the rear, she could still fire off an alpha strike of no less than 8 full-sized 21-inch torpedoes. With relatively little in the way of other Japanese shipping in the general area, Commander Heslett aboard the Trenchant let fly with his full forward spread. Ashigara's crew spotted the incoming torpedoes at the last moment, but pretty much exactly as designed, this dense pack of torpedoes left no room for escape, and the Ashigara took 5 hits in quick succession, sinking in less than 20 minutes and taking over 1,300 men, mostly troops bound for Singapore, with her. There was also an entire squadron of X-craft which showed up. These were mini-subs armed with massive demolition charges on either side. They were ready to go hunting for Japanese capital ships. Indeed, this was what they were specialised in. Most of the remaining capital ships of the Imperial Japanese Navy were being kept in port, partially due to lack of fuel and partly because the Japanese wanted to retain them for one grand final assault on the expected invasion of the home islands. But the crews of the X-craft were disappointed when the Americans reiterated their demand that any and all Japanese capital ships were entirely within the US Navy's purview. And so they went off to conduct various special forces operations instead, cutting the main telegraph cables to Japanese holdings in Southeast Asia, which in turn forced those areas to communicate with Japan via radio. And of course, radio transmissions could be intercepted and decoded. They also decided that, since heavy cruisers were not technically capital ships, they'd have a go at those as well, managing to blow the bottom out of Takao and leaving her resting on the harbour bottom as a result. Admittedly, they were going for Miyoko, but she turned out to be inboard of Takao, so they went after Takao instead. Specialist mine-laying submarines and a few specialist mine-laying ships also helped out enacting the mine blockade of Japan. But at the end of June 1945, the British Pacific Fleet sailed to meet Admiral Halsey and the Third Fleet, with the main force being made up of the carriers Formidable, Victorious, Implacable, and Indefatigable, with 4 escort carriers acting as aircraft replenishment vessels, and another escort carrier, the Ruler, escorting the fleet train. The maintenance carriers Unicorn and Pioneer backstopped the force to repair aircraft as the fleet would rotate back to Manus for resupply, with Indomitable remaining behind to meet up with another 4 carriers, all of the Colossus class, which were on their way to Australia from the UK. Illustrious was on her way home to the UK for more extensive repairs after it was found that the blast of a kamikaze's bomb, which had landed nearby in previous operations, had shaken loose a number of semi-temporary repairs that had been made some years earlier after she was bombed by the Luftwaffe in the Mediterranean. Various exercises were held on the way north to the Japanese coast, and appropriately enough, on the 4th of July 1945, Admiral Rawlings reported that Task Force 37, as it was known in US parlance, was ready for action. Admiral Rawlings was then duly invited on board the battleship Missouri, which was Admiral Halsey's flagship, at his earliest convenience to discuss ongoing plans. The two fleets met up by mid-July, with the Fast Carrier Task Force at this point down to 3 task groups as a result of kamikaze attrition. Rawlings was then offered 3 choices by Halsey. He could operate close with the Third Fleet, which would generally involve operating against the same targets or targets adjacent to those the US Navy was going after. He could operate semi-independently, perhaps 50 to 70 miles away, or he could operate completely independently, the latter of which would of course mean striking at his own targets of opportunity. Rawlings chose the first option, to stick with Third Fleet, as this would allow the greatest concentration of force and interoperability between the fleets. It would also mean that the British Pacific Fleet could detach its heavier units to help with shore bombardment, and some of the strengths of the British carriers, such as the frankly ridiculous climb rates of the Sea Fires when on point defence duty, and the durability of the carriers themselves if kamikazes showed up and could be baited into going after them, would multiply the overall effectiveness of the whole force. Halsey was pretty happy about this decision, as it played precisely into what he'd wanted the British Pacific Fleet for. Thus, the combined force headed for the Japanese coast with Task Force 37, which, as we said, is what the British Pacific Fleet was known as by the US Navy, positioned at the northern end of the formation. A number of British escort vessels, destroyers and cruisers, were dispatched to join their American counterparts in the outer defence ring, and a miniature air show ensued as both fleets flew off examples of their aircraft, which then went and buzzed the other fleet's ships to ensure that everybody's anti-aircraft gunners got at least some idea of what all the various Allied aircraft actually looked like. On the 17th of July, the combined fleet began launching its first strikes. The weather wasn't great, especially over the southernmost targets, and that meant that on the first day, the British Pacific Fleet actually hit twice as many targets as the US Navy, thanks to there being less cloud cover in their operational area. Various Japanese aircraft, runways, a few coastal ships, and a few trains were all blown up in exchange for 5 aircraft lost, of which 3 managed to reach the Allied escort screen before ditching, with the pilots therefore being picked up in short order. As the day wore on, the weather got worse, and so flying was cancelled. Instead, King George V went off to play with the Iowa, Wisconsin, Missouri, North Carolina, and Alabama. Although increasingly bad weather meant bombardment had to be done mostly using radar rather than visual spotting, and the limited visibility also precluded the use of spotting aircraft, with a commensurate effect on accuracy, the large number of misses, weirdly, ended up working out for the better. A great many shells that were fired at various factories missed entirely, and instead blew up nearby roads, train lines, and houses, all in the surrounding city of Hitachi, from which the company takes its name. This meant that a large number of the workforce then weren't able to make it into work the next day, either because they were picking themselves out of the rubble of their houses, or the various means of actually getting to work had been turned into smoking craters. And so when a B-29 incendiary bomber raid covered the area, well, with incendiaries, shockingly enough, many workers weren't at the factory, and without enough people to fight the fires, most of the industrialized area then promptly burned to the ground, which knocked out manufacturing there for quite a while. This wasn't the first time a Royal Navy bombardment of the Japanese coast, largely missing its intended target, had had unexpected benefits, but it's weird it happened twice. While bad weather continued, Halsey simply decided, well, the forces he had under his command were pretty mobile, so let's just go and sail to where the weather isn't quite as awful. After a bit of sailing southward, clearer skies saw strikes launched on the 18th, this time against airfields near Tokyo. Another 2 British aircraft were lost, and the reason for the British Pacific Fleet being assigned to these particular targets soon became clear, as American aircraft had all been sent after the battleship Nagato, which had been spotted not too far away in Yokosuka, and the US Navy was still very determined not to give the Fleet Air Armour the chance to slip up and give in to temptation and have a crack at a Japanese capital ship. As it turned out, Nagato had been moored in such a way that torpedoing it was pretty much impossible, so they had to resort to peppering it with bombs. Continued and spreading poor weather meant that everybody decided to head off to refuel and rearm early, and it wasn't until the 24th that flight operations were resumed. This time, the British were sent after airfields around Osaka, as well as the port of Osaka itself and shipping in the general area. Once more, this was in part to free up the US Navy's pilots who had been assigned to go after still more Japanese capital ships which had been spotted at Kure. Still, fate took something of a hand, and British Pacific Fleet Avengers found the small carrier Kaio sailing along, and with nothing else to do, decided to mortally wound her. They also sank a couple of D-type escort vessels, which were vessels were corvette-like in size and speed, but frigate-like in armament. They also took out a number of other small coastal craft. The airfield attacks also managed to set on fire a considerable number of Japanese aircraft for no loss to the British pilots. The following day's strikes would cost one Avenger, but then the weather caught up with the fleet again. Further strikes were cancelled, but the combat air patrol stayed up, which was just as well, as at sunset, three enemy formations were detected coming in on radar. Formidable's combat air patrol intercepted the first group, which turned out to be made up of four torpedo bombers. Three of them were shot down, and the last one fled. US radar-equipped night fighters then broke up the second group, and the third group decided, well, this whole thing seems like a bad idea, and so they turned for home without engaging. With the weather once more closed in, the combined forces decided, well, let's just go off and refuel and rearm again, with Halsey taking the chance to hold yet another briefing aboard the Missouri. On the 28th, another series of airstrikes were launched. These were aimed at a variety of targets toward the eastern end of the inland sea, and they did a lot of damage. But this time, the Japanese also mounted a fairly stiff resistance, costing the British Pacific Fleet eight aircraft, although all but two of their aircrew were recovered, as most of the aircraft lost were simply badly shot up and managed to make it back to the fleet before undertaking controlled ditching. US forces lost a further 27 in these engagements. On the 29th, King George V went off for another combined bombardment mission, and this time visibility was excellent, and so she managed to land a first salvo hit on a propeller factory from just over 20,000 yards. She was then joined by the Massachusetts, and their combined fire resulted in what were described as pleasingly visible fires. Bear in mind, these ships were over 11 miles away. That must have been some pretty impressive fire. Other US battleships went on to blow up a train factory and a railway line. On the 30th of July, everybody launched strikes that were aimed at shipping in Nagoya Bay, with the British Pacific Fleet claiming a frigate and the US Navy claiming several merchant ships, plus both parties sinking numerous smaller craft. This was in exchange for the loss of three aircraft on the British part. Reprovisioning was then made somewhat difficult by long wavelength high seas that presaged the coming of a typhoon. Luckily, by the 1st of August, the seas calmed again, as the typhoon had apparently decided to head to the west of Japan. Still, its zone of effect on the sea meant that Halsey decreed strikes would not resume until at least August the 5th. Then, poor weather was said to be likely to continue, and so this deadline was pushed back to the 8th. So everybody decided to have an extended refuel and resupply period. But Admiral Rawlings was then secretly briefed that the real reason for this second delay to the 8th was not because of the weather, but rather because of the imminent use of the atomic bomb and the desire to keep the fleet well away from the coast, just in case there were any unintended side effects. The Trinity tests had shown that you wouldn't ignite the entire planet's atmosphere with a nuclear weapon, but apparently there were still some concerns regarding spectacular possible side effects, if somewhat more limited ones. Hiroshima was of course hit on the 6th, with carrier strikes then scheduled for the 8th, but then cancelled, as it turned out, low cloud legitimately was interfering with operations on that day. The 9th saw shore bombardments and airstrikes launched against targets in the north of Japan, even as Nagasaki to the south was hit with a second atomic bomb. It was also on this day that Lieutenant Gray of the Royal Canadian Navy Volunteer Reserve, flying a Corsair off of HMS Formidable, would earn the last Victoria Cross of the war. His strike force was directed at a target of opportunity, believed to be a destroyer, but it turned out to be an escort or a frigate, depending on how you classify it. In any case, it was called the Amakusa. Leading the attack, his aircraft was hit by enthusiastic anti-aircraft fire and was itself set on fire. But Gray held his course, recognizing most likely that, with his engine rapidly dying, he was never going to pull out of this attack run. Instead, he released one of his 500-pound bombs, as the other one had been shot away, at point-blank range before his aircraft sailed past the ship and crashed into the sea. At the cost of his own life, Gray ensured the destruction of the Amakusa with a perfectly placed direct hit amidships. That day, overall, saw 44 Japanese aircraft, two warships, including the Amakusa, several ground installations, and a slew of coastal shipping all destroyed in exchange for the loss of 7 aircraft and 5 pilots. A series of shore bombardments that evening were conducted with several British cruisers joining the US bombardment force. The Soviets now also declared war, and so orders for the fleet were changed. Instead of heading back to base to refuel, rearm, and repair in preparation for operations supporting the invasion of Japan, further strikes were ordered to soften up northern Japan for a proposed Russian assault. This was a little bit of a problem, as the fleet train had already begun preparations to head home. But on the 10th, more strikes were duly flown off, with 6 aircraft being lost in exchange for the sinking of another 2 warships, the destruction of numerous ground targets, half a dozen coastal merchant ships, and a few more enemy aircraft that came out to play. Overall, Japanese losses in aircraft were assessed at around 720 by Allied planners during these August strikes by the British and American fleets. Most aircraft, understandably, were destroyed on the ground, but a few were caught in the air and shot down as well. Now, another typhoon was forecast, this one coming past to the east, and so attacks planned for the 12th were cancelled, and the 11th was to be spent refuelling. During this period, Halsey and Rawlings brought their flagships up on either side of the tanker USS Sabine, which allowed for another private briefing. Both admirals agreed that the war had only days left to run, and since both the Royal Navy and the US Navy had depleted their tanker forces by hanging around for an additional refueling cycle compared to what they'd planned for, a good number of their ships would have to be sent back to base to allow those left to be kept off the coast until fresh tankers could be brought up. Since the time between the theoretical cessation of hostilities and the actual formal surrender was at that point unknown, Rawlings chose to keep King George V, Indefatigable, Gambia, and Newfoundland, plus 10 destroyers, with him. The battleship Duke of York and 2 further destroyers would set out to join them from Guam with Admiral Fraser aboard. This significantly reduced force, along with the US ships that stuck around, then set out to launch strikes around Tokyo on the 13th. Despite, at this point, the theoretical acceptance by the Japanese of the Allied surrender terms, that day saw almost 24 Japanese aircraft approach the fleet, mostly in 1s and 2s, all of which were then intercepted and shot down for no losses on the Allied side. At the close of the day, though, a rather amusing set of signals was sent from Halsey to Rawlings and back. First was an American request to prepare 2,000 men for armed landing parties, with a reply that, with the reduced forces available to him, there were only about 1,500 rifles and other small arms available. This was followed up by a clarification that the first message was a typo and Halsey had actually meant 200 men, which was then followed by Rawlings asking, could you increase that a bit, as that first message had caused quite a lot of excitement. Halsey promptly agreed and doubled his request to 400 men. The 15th would see another series of strikes. This time a full-on dogfight developed when 2 Zeros were spotted below the attacking formation. This was correctly assessed as a decoy force designed to draw the escort away, as another dozen Zeros were soon spotted coming in much higher. However, at this point in the war, the Sea Fire was by far the better aircraft, and despite there being 50% more Japanese fighters in the air than there were Sea Fires, the British only lost 1 aircraft, which was shot down due to a faulty radio, which meant the pilot received no warning of the incoming attack. The rest of the Sea Fires then shot down 4 Zeros for definite, with another 4 rated as probably shot down, and it in turn suffered no further losses, with one pilot ramping his engine up to full power, mercilessly exploiting his near 600 horsepower advantage over the Zeros to engage a pair of them with his lone aircraft in a vicious turning dogfight in which he comprehensively outmaneuvered and shot down both enemy aircraft, in part by simply retaining his energy while the Japanese aircraft gradually lost theirs thanks to the Spitfire's greatly superior power-to-weight ratio. One Avenger was badly damaged by a Zero that got through the escorts and was forced to ditch near friendly shipping, with its crew being recovered. But the shot-down Seafire pilot, Fred Hockley, suffered a particularly cruel fate. He survived bailing out from his stricken aircraft, and despite the Emperor's surrender order being broadcast that same day, Japanese officers, after hearing it, decided to murder him out of hand anyway. Fortunately, though, the officers who gave that order, as well as the one who carried it out, were tracked down after the war and then either executed or imprisoned for the war crime, depending on the level of responsibility assigned to each man by the courts. At 1100 on the 15th, all further strikes were cancelled due to Japan's formal acceptance of the Allied surrender terms and the aforementioned broadcast by the Emperor, although several more lone attacks would come in during the afternoon, all of which were shot down, and thus the fleet stood ready to deal with any other unwelcome intruders in accordance with Halsey's orders to shoot them down in a friendly manner. Rawlings reminded everyone that while it was possible that they would continue to be attacked, since they were now officially at peace, they could start getting rid of the various camouflage schemes. He followed this up with a signal to Admiral Fraser, asking what precise shade of grey was appropriate for the fleet now. Halsey, on the other hand, had gotten so used to having the British around that shortly after broadcasting his victory speech, he also signalled splice the main brace, which of course was the command to issue an extra tot of rum, before then having to amend it to all task group commanders except those of the American groups. Although, naturally, for American officers serving as liaisons aboard the British vessels, it would be impossibly rude not to partake of the local customs. The 16th saw Halsey bring the entire fleet close in for a series of high-speed operations that made for excellent photo opportunities, which was, of course, the entire point. In this, they were joined by HMS Duke of York, which had taken a little bit of a detour on its way to visit Guam, where Admiral Nimitz was inducted into the Order of the Bath, for which Admiral Fraser had quickly invented a tradition on the spot of the recipient of said Order of the Bath being plied with grog in every single one of the officers' messes or wardrooms, starting with the Admiral's quarters and finishing down in the warrant officer's mess. Having returned a thoroughly pickled Nimitz to his staff for safekeeping, they'd set out for the Japanese coast, arriving 4 days later for the photo opportunity. After more photo opportunity manoeuvres on the 17th, Fraser headed over to the Missouri, where Halsey was made a Knight Commander of the British Empire, although since this investiture was aboard an American ship, there wasn't a chance to test the American Admiral's alcohol limits. On the 20th, the landing force was called up to transfer to some American assault destroyers. In the interim, this 400-man force had mysteriously grown to no less than 536 once a final headcount was taken. A typhoon warning delayed proceedings for a few days, and Halsey decided to use the 22nd to conduct a massed flyover made up of pretty much every operational aircraft in the Allied fleet. And then on the 23rd, Duke of York and Missouri, along with a minimal destroyer escort, began to lead the way into Japanese home waters. In between further typhoon warnings and various minesweeping efforts, the fleet crept rather slowly towards its objectives, but the British ships took the delay as a chance to finish repainting, as well as taking paint off various bits of brasswork and giving it all a good polish. Admiral Rawlings issued orders that all ships were to fly at least two large white ensigns upon entering Japanese waters, although Commonwealth ships were allowed to substitute their national flag for one of them. Finally, on the 29th, the Missouri and the Duke of York entered Tokyo Bay, followed shortly thereafter by Nimitz aboard the USS South Dakota. Over the next couple of days, the rest of the fleet filed in, including the destroyer Whelp, which had one Philip Mountbatten aboard. I wonder what he'd get up to later in life. On the 2nd of September, there was, of course, the formal surrender ceremony, and in finest British tradition, despite the very best efforts of Missouri's crew, Admiral Fraser made off with the pen that he'd used to sign his part of the relevant documents with. And then, that evening, HMS Duke of York hoisted the ensigns of all Allied navies on the mainmast and the flags of all the nations in the British Empire and Commonwealth on its foremast. And then, as the sun set, all the ensigns were lowered, and finally, the white ensign was hauled down for the very first time aboard a British warship at sea in almost exactly 6 years. For the battleship itself, commissioned during wartime, it was in fact the very first time it had done so at sea, since during times of war, in the Royal Navy, the white ensign is never lowered as long as a ship is at sea with water under its keel. The war was officially over, but there was much work still to be done. In addition to locating and recovering prisoners of war on the Japanese mainland, there were many Japanese-held territories outside the home islands where individual surrenders had to be organised. In this, the newly arrived Colossus-class light fleet carriers were quite useful. They'd shown up the day after the Japanese had indicated that they were in fact surrendering. HMS Glory was dispatched to accept the surrender of Rabaul and the surrounding area, while various other forces of the British Pacific Fleet headed for Hong Kong, Singapore, and a number of other locations. There was some tension over the matter of Hong Kong, as the British were determined to take it back, as well as any other colonies that they'd had taken from them by the Japanese, but Hong Kong was a nexus of trade and therefore very important to post-war British plans. But the US declared that it was opposed to the resumption of colonialism and didn't want them to take it back, despite at that very moment the US formalising its reoccupation of the Philippines, but the less said about that the better. Now, while there was a three-way standoff between the British, the Americans, and the Chinese nationalists, who also wanted to take Hong Kong, the entire thing ended up being resolved by the former colonial secretary, who'd been held prisoner there since December 1941. He simply walked up to the government building, declared that he was now back in charge, and ordered the Japanese officials out, and then hoisted the Union Jack. At that point, presented with something of a fait accompli, everybody eventually agreed, well, let's just simply accept this status quo on the ground because it means less potential aggro, and so a fleet of Royal Navy vessels then showed up to formalise matters, with aircraft from the newly arrived HMS Venerable, another Colossus-class carrier, having to attack a trio of suicide boats which tried to head towards the fleet from a hidden anchorage, where a couple of hundred more were soon discovered, although these were uncrewed. As the various Japanese-held territories were reoccupied, there were now just two more duties left to the British Pacific Fleet. The larger of the two was repatriating the liberated prisoners of war and the tens of thousands of service personnel who could now be taken home. This was the equivalent of the US magic carpet missions, and to this end, the carriers with their large hangars and flight decks were seen as ideal. This also provided an opportunity to deal with the other duty, reducing the UK's war bill. Under the terms of Lend-Lease, any American-provided war material would have to be paid for or returned at British expense at the end of the agreement, unless, of course, it had been lost in the course of combat operations. With the deal now due to expire, since the war was over, huge numbers of Hellcats, Corsairs, and Avengers, which weeks before had been valuable tools in the Allied offensive, were unceremoniously poked full of holes and then deep-sixed over the side of various British carriers, some conducting repeated runs to and from Australia in order to get out into deeper waters and send another load over the side. In the short term, these aircraft would be replaced by Barracudas, Seafires and Fireflies, although some Corsairs were also kept around. These would be kept in operation until newer British aircraft could be introduced to replace them all. And so the British Pacific Fleet gradually began to wind down. Although it would technically remain in existence until 1948, when it was renamed to the Far East Station, the majority of its activity, and of course all of its wartime activity, was now over. And so this is where we will leave our story as well, as the account of the various repatriation voyages by both the US and British Pacific Fleets is really its own video, which will be made at some point in the future.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.